2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 122, A Church Observed, papers presented by David Pace and Cheryl Pace.
Smokehouse. I'm not smoking. This is a posted non-smoking room, despite the name. Just to make sure you're in the right session, the title of this session is Conversion Statistics and Stories of Mormon Transvestites in the Southern States, 1908 to 1912. So if you're not in the right one, you could please. Okay, now that everyone's awake, we're going to do something else in lieu of that program. We have a great hour planned for you. Just want to make sure we've got to go through the laundry list here. You should only be here if you have paid for the privilege and should have a name tag or a ticket. Unfortunately, from my standpoint, I'm not able to announce any books for sale that I know of yet. Is that right? Okay. Please turn off any noisemakers. Now, why anyone would bring noisemakers to a Sunstone session, I don't know. And then at the conclusion, I will introduce briefly our speakers. At the conclusion, we will have a question and answer session, and we're going to see how that goes, but there should be plenty of time, and if you don't have enough questions, we'll make sure that there are some. Our first speaker is going to be David Pace, who is currently trying to sell a novel, which makes me very sympathetic because I want him to be successful in finding a publisher and selling lots of copies through my store. By the way, my name is Kurt Bench. I own Benchmark Books. They always like to have a bench chair a session whenever possible, so they always ask me every year to chair a session. David has been a flight attendant for several years. He teaches writing and introduction to film at the Utah campus of the University of Phoenix and also at Westminster College, and he has been a noted stage critic. And The way that I actually didn't know him, but was introduced to his family when I was going to BYU, I took his father for religion courses, I don't even know how many times. His father, George Pace, kind of took me under his wing, really helped me along, was a great influence on me. And so I've been exposed to the Paces for quite some years, but it's a privilege for me to be able to introduce David and his wife Cheryl, who I'm told is from a Yankee family in Massachusetts. Now, I went on a mission to the South, and there we were Yam Dankies. If you weren't from the South, or another, you could switch those first letters if you were from anywhere other than the South. But she's a true Yankee. Comes from a family of artists and musicians and craftsmen. She has done a number of things, including working for a couple of newspapers, the Event newspaper, Catalyst magazine, where she wrote a consumer column, and she also worked for Clifton Jolly at Advent Communications as a legal researcher and as a book reviewer, which, again, we just can't escape these books. A cradle Episcopalian. Cheryl's first love is homemaking and hanging out with Josiah, her grandson. She grows killer squash and tomatoes in her Utah garden, and of course they must have realized that that was going to beg a question. When does the film Killer Squash come out? We've had killer tomatoes, so we're looking forward to killer squash. Okay, I think you've heard enough from me. I will now turn the time over to David Pace.
Good morning. I think I'd rather hear that other session you talked about. I experience my morning life as having traversed a three-stage journey through pride and prejudice. In the first stage, I was an obedient, card-carrying Latter-day Saint. But even as early as ninth grade, I felt out of step and competitive with other Mormons and dishonest with myself. Inevitably, I did not feel I could bring my true, unvarnished self to my family or to the religious community I belonged to. In most ways, my parents were the religion, fused as they were to the institution, and in turn fused indelibly with us, their children. And I felt that I could not voice my opinion. I could only speak in the generally accepted language of the fullness of the gospel plan, but not from the fullness of my experience. As a 30-year-old stage critic in Salt Lake, a satire of Mormon life, as in the stage play Saturday's Voyeur, angered me because it violated the silence I had felt imposed on me by my upbringing and the church. And that violation threatened me terribly, mostly because it was someone, something other than myself, who was challenging the program and reflecting on it in unapproved ways. The second stage of my Mormon life, for me, was my full embrace of what I will call the dissidents, a rural community that seemed to promise a home where I could bring my individual voice rather than just the collective one to the Mormon conversation. Finally, I thought, I had found a place where I could trust other Mormons. I now read Dialogue and Sunstone magazines, which were often critical of the church, as faithfully as I once read The Ensign and listened to General Conference. I attended and presented at symposiums and at the short-lived Sunday gatherings. For a while, the relief of having broken my silence carried me along. Soon, however, I decided that I had simply exchanged one problem for another. As a dissident, I could no longer be close to my Mormon family and friends. Furthermore, it was a short walk from being a judgmental loyalist to being a judgmental dissident. I became a critic. Other critics seemed as threatened by me as I was by them. No one's perception of the church seemed as legitimate as my own, exactly as before. And still, I did not trust anyone. In the end, the church and its critics were just two sides of the same coin, offering only two wholly reactionary places for a Mormon to go: the Temple Square of Loyalists, or the Temple Square of dissidents turned critics. Self-defining action did not seem available in either. So I left everything. Not only did I resign my LDS church membership, but I returned my diploma to BYU to protest what I saw as the disintegration of academic freedom. At the same time, I lost as much respect for the new Temple Square as I had lost respect for the old one. What's more, I left Utah and moved to New York City. Anything to get away from what I saw as a hopelessly divided system that required I exist in either one unlivable space or another. In New York, however, things did not improve. I brought both Temple Squares with me. The fear of a real self being exposed, the fear of not being liked, and the propensity for judgment. I survived, as I always had, as a skilled performer for everyone around me, including my wife, including even myself. The compartmentalized thinking that allowed me to separate my acceptable from my unacceptable self in Mormonism now morphed in my new life to compartmentalized behaviors that served the same purpose. Soon I was living different lives which were wildly incompatible. It seemed I had made a series of lateral moves, from the performance of loyalist to the performance of a dissident to the performance of a free man. Up until this point, both my Episcopal wife and I saw Mormonism as the enemy that was continuing to destroy me and that could not be transcended. When I finally hit bottom, something had to happen. Somewhere, and it did, somewhere amongst desperation, the survival instinct, and grace, I found what worked for me. To control my actions rather than perform them, to surrender to the sound of individual as opposed to institutional conscience, to respond rather than to react. And it was Cheryl, the non-Mormon observer, who one day pointed out to me that in order to heal, I was relying on tacit and very Mormon ways of thinking and behaving. Things like faith in the power of a like-minded community of individuals with the same assumptions and experiences. Things like a confidence that working within a structured and time-honored program will eventually yield promised results. Things like the assumption that one has to pioneer for change, to endure suffering, and to act as if everything relies on individual fortitude. Things like understanding the need for authority figures and social structures. Things like the idea one has to first act a certain way in order to become a certain person. In this, the third stage of my Mormon experience, I am faced with the fact that, one, what I learned as a Mormon had become the source of my disease, or my dis-ease, and two, what I learned as a Mormon became the source of my deliverance. This caused me to wonder about how I was raised and who I have become. Let me briefly share in detail a Mormon value that I believe is not as readily available in the broader culture. Afterwards, I would like briefly to list several other values that I feel Mormons of every stripe are perhaps proud to be identified with. Mormons are nonconformist, particularly as they relate to the world. Yes, Mormons have been called super-Americans because of their middle-class conservative values, but I am arguing that you are nonconformist nonetheless. Why? Because Mormons honor the imagination. They seek to be inspired, to be innovative. Admittedly, this has at times led to throat-slitting revelators trolling through Utah suburbs. But I am here to remind us all that it was thinking outside the box that led to the Prophet Joseph Smith to do amazing things. Brigham Young also had a powerful imagination. He had to imagine a Zion before he could attempt to build it. Perhaps this is one reason why he loved the theater so much. It was a highly imaginative and imagined space next to a Dead Sea, a physical reminder that because of stagnation, it had poisoned itself. The code of the early pioneers may well have been, imagining change is not a threat, but not imagining it is a threat. Mormons are wired to think outside the box. Which box? All of them. Community, commerce, education, family and social organization, politics, the body, the mind, the soul, eternity, grace, and works. It was my Mormon nonconformity that allowed me to think my life could be other than what it had become. And it was Mormon experience with programs, education, community, and the relentless perfectibility of humankind that allowed me to actualize that imagined outcome. Nice save. There are many other values and characteristics unique to Mormons, and of which you are the keepers in this complex, divided, and often confused world. Here's a short list of how I experience you and why we would all be wise to preserve Mormonism and its church for Mormons and for the world. Number one, last year I stood here and explained how temple weddings divide Mormon families as much as they bring them together. I still believe that. And yet there is a prevailing ethic in the church that family matters. And this ethic, regardless of the backwash, devastating as it is to many, including to my wife and to me, family loyalty and connecting with ancestors and one's heritage is fortunately, in my view, enshrined. Number two, Mormons are creative and artistic. You're perhaps looking for evidence of your creative spirit in a museum or in a book, when you should be looking next to the hearth. A proportionately higher percentage of Mormons still engage in home life as part of an integrated creative and artistic life compared to non-Mormons in North America. That's my opinion. In a world where many have mistaken retail and selectivity as a creative act, Mormons see the home as something to take pride in, to create in, to see as an occupation. The same is true of child care. It's an occupation for both women and men. What other group is led by a prophet who will stand at the podium and chastise its members for having unkept homes, yards, and farms? In what other women's organization is quilting, cooking, and gardening extolled, along with education, good health, and compassionate service? Number three. Mormons are said to have meetings to plan meetings to plan meetings to plan more meetings, and yet partly because of this you are savvy in organizational ways. You believe in authority and in teamwork. The Mormon addict, for example, is custom made for a 12-step program. Your priesthood organization is perfectly designed to raise millions of dollars overnight for starving Ethiopians, or within hours to mobilize the troops to sandbag homes and streets from the spring runoff. Number four, despite higher than average Prozac popping, Mormons don't seem to question the wisdom that God placed them in their Mormon path. Your plight seems to have meaning simply because you were born to it. Not unlike my understanding of the Jewish concept of the faithful remnant, it is part of having faith in the Creator. From this meaning, Mormons seem to see restored religion as needing to be preserved at any cost. Number five. What about that little thing Mormon critics refer to as indoctrination? Instilled fear in the tender mind and hearts of children? Even so, in a world where values can seem transient or even non-existent, you take socialization of children seriously. There are formal rites of passage, especially for young men. Training and education are also considered vital. Number six. Why not celebrate rather than hide from your polygamous past? It's worth celebrating. Though it's impractical and even arguably undesirable now, plural marriage could be viewed as an example that we can look beyond conventional attitudes about sexuality, largely expunged of any spiritual element. In a nation suffering from a relentlessly adolescent take on sex as an act, we need permission to converse beyond the charged atmosphere and address not just sex, but sexuality. Seven, I experience Mormons as a progressive people. Your God seems to be one who still reveals his will today in the spirit of the Restoration. This leads you to embrace technology, science, education, and quote-unquote advancement of the human species. For example, stem cell research. This is part of the lofty, though admittedly maddening, concept of the perfectibility of each of God's children. Number eight. Mormons believe in the natural laws of the universe extending to spiritual things. It seems to me that for you, natural law governs not only the physical world, but also the consequences to your behavior, your sins, and your good works. Even grace in Mormon doctrine seems to me to be a consequence of natural law. With this incomplete list in front of me, I still question what the baby is as opposed to the bathwater. If these positive, life-affirming values are present in Mormonism, how was it that I nearly drowned in its bathwater? One last thing. Did I mention that I believe Mormons are inclusive?
Good morning. David has just used the words Mormons and inclusive in the same sentence. I bet you're surprised. Thank you. That's okay. I admit we chose our terms carefully and maybe even for their shock value. We were hoping to get your attention, but at no point as we prepared for this session were we willing to sacrifice our sincerity. I think I have too much at stake. My grandson was born here, and the mathematical odds are that he'll fall for a Mormon girl and not another Episcopalian. My Mormon parents-in-law are the only parents I have. David came with 10 sisters, now married, with 37 children among them. They're all active in the church. With the exception of my one brother-in-law and his partner, I have no other family west of New England, no old friends. I live in an extended Mormon family and a dominantly Mormon community entirely by choice, 2,500 miles from New England, where I spent the first 40 years of my life. And yet, although I choose to live here, I'm bound, as you can see, by powerful and emotional ambivalence to both the extreme frustration with Mormon behavior and thinking that is so commonplace among non-Mormons, and to the desperate defensiveness that seems to characterize Mormons themselves. So it follows that I'm devastated not only by the impact that Mormon indoctrination appears to have had on my husband, many of his family members, and several close friends, but also by the accusations that Mormons, and therefore my intimates, are mindless or cultist or any of the other pejorative terms used so routinely to describe the dominant culture here. As an outsider married in, it isn't as though I don't know that I will forever remain an outsider. But I'm claiming to be close enough to witness and to experience an impressively large family of Mormons as people of unusual intelligence and character, who, as a matter of course, transform the courage of conviction into creative work, problem-solving, child-raising, and partnerships. And I'm claiming to be married to one of Mormonism's finest sons, who deserves better than the condescension he so often receives among family members and among old friends still active in the church. In addition to my intimate connections, however, there is the simple truth that I feel hypocritical if I express opinions about zealous religious conflict anywhere in the world, because in my home city, we seem only breath away at times from emotionally violent conflict, even or perhaps especially within families. We all seem to know about it to varying degrees. A few of us even seem inclined to address it. All of us, however, seem to have failed to address it successfully. Finally, it is my view that the sweeping objectification of others that is the heart of prejudice is in our veins, our very needs as a community. With our prejudicial predisposition as a community, while our prejudicial predisposition as a community seems to trace to roots within the LDS Church, among a people who appear to find even each other suspect, from its roots in the church that dominates our social and political landscape, prejudice seems to radiate outward and to have made frightened bigots of us all. It is my view that if we cannot transform objectification of others into identification with others, then we are condemning ourselves to a kind of wartime mentality. We always need our gooks and our commies and our krauts and now our camel jockeys. Peacetime will not meet our needs. In my experience, Mormon loyalists and Mormon dissidents only seem to bond when they find themselves confronted by a common enemy, the critical non-Mormon. But the new ecumenical rhetoric in Salt Lake City has made us all, oh so self-consciously, politically correct, especially with regard to the Mormon-non-Mormon divide. Politically correct, but utterly unchanged in our predisposition to prejudicial thinking. One could argue, then, that we need a new enemy, a common enemy. I think the proposed state amendment, in its effort to define marriage arrangements, and in its direct opposition to civil rights thinking, stands as one of the most telling testimonies to our disturbing need. The new common enemy, it seems, is anyone who fails to share our concept of morality. The new enemy is pure object. It is evil, it is faceless, and if that doesn't scare us, perhaps it should. So my campaign to understand Mormonism at both the personal and institutional level and to undermine prejudice in my home city is just about as personal a cause as one comes by. I don't expect to be able to hide between either cool intellectualism or proof-weighted legalism as I address you. That said, let me circle back to where I started. David has used the term inclusive as an adjective that describes Mormons in Salt Lake City, usage that very likely bears some explanation. For my first 2 weeks in the West, before my rapid and all too willing initiation into vaulting prejudice, I was experiencing a kind of inclusiveness I had never experienced in the East. While it may be true that the Mormon state of Utah is less socially and politically tolerant of racial, religious, and lifestyle differences, those of us fortunate enough to live in a largely Mormon world can include, publicly and socially, not only without shame and embarrassment, but perhaps even with a little pride, our unruly children, our confused elderly, our infirm, our deformed, our handicapped, our poor, and our workforce of women at home. I didn't even know that these groups were not an acceptable part of my society until I came here.
Sure, speak into the microphone.
Okay. Where they are so acceptably public. There are clean public places for mothers to nurse and to change their babies. Public buildings are handicapped accessible and traffic lights sound for the deaf. But most of all, the general public here does not seem to cast an unwelcome glance in the direction of children as though they have nothing more to offer than frustration, to look through the elderly as though they have nothing left to contribute but inconvenience, to look past the disadvantaged as though it is just too frightening to notice they exist at all. And to be left speechless when the answer to the question, what do? Is, I'm a housewife, an essential job category, in my view, for which feminism seemed to find no acceptable solution and so instead chose wholesale denial. So far as these important but largely powerless groups are concerned, I live in the most respectful and accommodating place I have ever lived. And I can't share the view that Utah is somehow behind the rest of the world, intolerant, narrow-minded, caught in a time warp. The world outside Utah may have moved to embrace alternate lifestyles, races, and religions, but at what price? Arguably, it was a lateral move and not a progressive one. As a wider community of powerful adults was let into the inner circle, the less powerful were increasingly edged out, I think. David and I came here from 7 years in Brooklyn, New York, one of the five boroughs of New York City, the city that sets the standard for tolerance and progressive thinking. except that a young mother can only use the subway system if she can carry her baby, her baggage, and her stroller up and down endless flights of stairs while she is being pushed by a moving throng. Our elderly neighbor could meet his friends every day at the free afternoon movie at the Museum of Modern Art. The subway stairs did not intimidate Edmund, but he had to leave at 9 a.m. to get there by 2 p.m. The point is, Salt Lake City doesn't embrace diversity as well as it could. But in my view, it is integrated to an enviable degree. For me, the more homogeneous world is the one I left, not the one I came to. It was a strictly adult world of pavis, powerful, attractive, verbal, and intelligent. Also adult. My social diet was strictly pavi, albeit of every color and calling, like a diet of vegetable spirals, colorful but nonetheless all pasta, not a diet one can live on. As you might guess, one lived in such a world with a subcutaneous fear of the inevitable, or usually inevitable, having children, aging, illness. Let's not forget the biggie, losing one's job and whatever status came with it, which was the same thing as losing one's very social identity. In New York, one seemed to be defined entirely by the answer to the inevitable question, what do you do? My answer was, I'm a housewife. Frankly, to have been brown, lesbian, and atheist would have been a step up the ladder for me. At the very least, it would have catapulted me into public discourse as a worthy participant. And so I am claiming that Utah is inclusive because I'm finally included. I'm claiming to have a freedom to be and an opportunity for respect here that I didn't have elsewhere. But I am also claiming to have been introduced to vile Mormon, anti-Mormon prejudice in common public settings among strangers within weeks of my arrival, and to be witness to an even more vile prejudice among Mormons themselves. Without exception, entirely without exception, every Mormon with whom I have had any conversation about the commonly touted Mormon profile has agreed, hands down, with that prejudicial view, but has ended his or her detailed horror story of Mormon character with a caveat, my family was different. There hasn't been a single exception. Whether active or disenfranchised, each has eventually justified him or herself and his or her family by slandering other Mormons and claiming to be different. I have come to suspect that above all else, as arguably American blacks and women once were, Mormons are a self-hating people. For the purposes of the moment, let me assume that each of you resonates to David's experiences and trusts my claims and suppositions. If that's so, then I can further assume that we agree that two things are generally true. First, that the LDS Church is a rare wellspring of perspectives that potentially contribute to individual and community viability, health, a better life. And second, that the potential for LDS contribution in our community is undermined, one might even argue stopped in its tracks, by the harmful effects of prejudice and divisiveness within its own ranks. That divisiveness appears to cost the LDS Church its champions, or certainly many of them, to ineffectual mistrust in one camp, which we are calling the dissident camp, and to an equally ineffectual silence in the other camp, which we are calling the loyalist camp. For the purposes of the moment, I would like to assume that we agree that Mormons who choose to engage Mormon discourse have an active and enduring interest in the well-being of the formal organization of the LDS Church, in the spiritual quality of its ideology, and in loving and correct service, not only to its members, but to the community of which it is a part, and that as these Mormons engage their cause publicly, they feel forced into one or the other of two mutually ineffectual camps, the dissident camp or the loyalist camp. If these assumptions hold true, then devoted Mormons need a third alternative to dissident mistrust and the alienation that seems to be its inevitable consequence, and to silent loyalty and the isolation that seems to be its inevitable consequence. Mormon affiliates seem to need a third camp where individual conscience can freely inspire constructive action, where the critical eye of the dissident and the organizational backbone of the loyalist meet and respectfully inform one another to create another kind of Mormon altogether, a connected, self-affirming Mormon, a follower in the very best sense of that word. Ira Chalif, in his book, The Courageous Follower, speaks, I think, to the role of follower in the very best sense of that word. Writes Chalif, follower is not synonymous with subordinate. A subordinate reports to an individual of higher rank and may in practice be a supporter, an antagonist, or indifferent. A follower shares a common purpose with a leader, believes in what the organization is trying to accomplish, and wants both the leader and the organization to succeed. End quote. Having companioned a journey out of the LDS Church, I wouldn't wish the experience on my worst enemy. Few of us are designed for the extreme course of the expatriate. Few of us are prepared to lose our very identity and homeland, as it were. To make the decision to leave everything familiar behind and attach ourselves to the unknown. To leave the LDS Church, in my view, means nothing less than that. But subordination hardly seems to be a better course. Therefore, it seems reasonable to believe that to belong to the Church as a loving follower is simultaneously to accept the risk of punitive response, that is, disfellowship or excommunication. The irony seems to be that the greater your dedication to the core values and purposes of your church, the greater your personal risk. I don't think there's any respectable, non-prejudicial way to feel artificially safe. And I think if you make yourself feel safe, then you do so at the expense of the church you love. I want LDS influence to thrive in my community because that's why I finally fit in somewhere. And of course, I don't want my intimates to suffer. I want to live in a community that is united around common causes, not common enemies. It's personal with me. And so I'm asking you to hold on. To identify with one another, to trust each other and your leaders, then find your voices and use them. That's what I'm here to say. Writes Chalif, followers and leaders both orbit around the purpose. Followers do not orbit around the leader. We are responsible. Whether we lead or follow, we are responsible for our own actions, and we share responsibility for the actions of those whom we can influence. If we are not willing to risk whatever relationship we have built with leadership by providing honest feedback, we instead risk losing the whole dream for which we have both been working. We will grow more cynical about leadership, and leadership will grow increasingly unreal about the impact of its behavior. Thank you.
And we should have plenty of time for questions and answers. If you could, they would like for you to ask your question over the microphone. If not, then someone needs to repeat the question for the tape. So If there's anything that's irritating is when you buy these tapes and you can never hear the questions. Please keep them brief and to the point, no lengthy comments, or, you know, just if you could ask a question and identify which you would like to answer the question. Okay. So do you want to field your own? I mean, you're gonna need to be at the mic anyway.
Okay.
As well.
So,
yeah, if you can.
Do you have any questions today? Yes. Hugo.
Maybe I'm a little bit puzzled when you say that Mormons can think outside the box. Maybe Brigham Young and Joseph Smith thought about outside the box. When I think about the respectability that Mormons have been trying to obtain in the 20th century, when I think about what this country has become in the last 50 years, only in the last 4 years for that matter, this embrace of conservative, traditional, family-oriented Mormon values or Christian values, and when I'm thinking of the direction that this country is going, I think that Mormons helped shape the box, and maybe they helped shape the box within the box.
We have a nesting doll going on here, right? Box within the box. Well, I think that, Hugo, your opinion is accurate, but I think what I'm trying to get at is that I don't think Mormons are as monolithic as everybody thinks they are, including Mormons. And you know that if you get them in a corner alone where they don't have to use their name. And there's fear. There's fear to voice their opinion, which I think is extremely varied. Now, when the rubber meets the road, though, it would appear that everyone's in jackboots marching down the street in unison. And you know, that may be true, but two things that I want to say. One is that there's value in having the ethic of something. And I think that the ethic of being an imaginative people built into our theology and into our history is legitimate. I think that the history says that we were an imaginative people. We were flying in the face of Victorian wars during polygamy. We were reinventing what it meant to live communally. We were... Ooh, am I saying we? Scandal. You were coming up with new political structures, new organizations, and how to farm, for heaven's sakes. I mean, if you go out into the countryside of Utah, you know, you've got the farms and farms outside the town, but everybody had to live inside the farm, the small town, in order for Mormonism to work. So, all of that to say, the second thing I wanted to say to, and to try to avoid your questions at all costs, is that statistically, we don't have a lot of statistics about the sleeping giant out there. But just general, risible statistics, there's a lot of people, first of all, that don't go to church, a lot of Mormons that don't, probably more than 50%. Is that fair? Of the 11, 12 million? And out of that percentage, less than half, I argue, can go to the temple. So you're talking about a lot of people that are excluded and have some kind of problem, okay, with Orthodox Mormonism or institutional church. I think what Cheryl is arguing is that these voices need to come to the front. And I think, quite frankly, it will happen. May not happen in our lifetimes, but I think that the center cannot hold anymore, because we're talking about a system that is at least looking at it from one angle, is using fear in order to control. And that sort of thing doesn't last forever. Soviet Union didn't. Anyway, I don't know if I answered your question. We'll arm wrestle about it later.
Yes, please.
Whoa. It's a legitimate question. And I think perhaps we failed to make it known that we understand the shortcomings of our community. That's clear. But there is no perfect liberal mind, no perfect conservative mind, but a value and disadvantage, so far as I'm concerned, to every aspect of our being. There is a value to being a housewife for me, because my cause is women, of course. But there's also a tremendous problem with it that Betty Friedan came marching to the fore with in the 70s. It's a problem we haven't solved. So the answer to your question is, yes, we create boxes here. And we harbor, I think, as a community, one of the greatest potentials for eliminating them. Thank you.
Cheryl, I've got a question that you can repeat. You mentioned that David is condescending to
us. Yes, yes.
By his family and friends. Do you think this is a result of the family and friends? Do you think this is a result of the church leaders or the church culture talking that way, or is the failure of the family and friends to live up to the ideals of Christ that the church is giving?
Yes, he's asking whether condescension to David from family and friends within the church is a result of leadership or the failure of individuals to live up to the principles of the church. Is that fairly accurate? Well, for openers, I have to say, I've never been Mormon, and to speak to Mormon principles and ideology would be extraordinarily presumptuous. I simply can't address that. I don't have the expertise or credentials to do so. But I believe that there's a relationship between church leadership and the what we in Episcopalianism call the parishioners, so that at some point those individuals are acting in a way that they feel is approved of by leadership. I think that would be a reasonable assumption in any organization. But yeah, people are people, and condescension is an expression of fear. So the real question isn't, whose fault is it that you're condescending? We can go down that road, and then we'll be here all day arguing, and then we'll go home dissatisfied. Or we can understand that condescension is a kind of fear, and when we go home tonight, perhaps reflect on what we're afraid of.
You know, one of the common things in the political debate field today is, can the United States live in isolation by the fact that nobody loves themselves as much as Americans love themselves? I kind of look at that same way with the Mormon Church. Can they live in isolation and exist by the fact that nobody loves themselves as much as Mormons love themselves? As far as Mormons are concerned, you know, other Mormons are great, but other people are not necessarily great unless they're Mormons. I continually hear people say, well, they're a good person, but they're not a Mormon. And there's nothing that gripes me more than to hear that "but." My question is, can the Mormon Church live in isolation as they have in the past, in the future, and continue to be a religious organization of any power and success?
The answer to this one's a little easier. If those damn Mormons are trying to live in isolation, why are we all so mad?
If I understood you correctly, you indicated, Cheryl, that that we should speak out. And of course, I think most of us that have been in Mormon culture realize quite clearly that to speak out publicly and say anything that is in any way negative, we know what the result is. Are you asking us to keep sacrificing our membership in the church doing that? Or I assume you realize that's the consequence from what we know. Now, I don't speak out publicly, but in my ward, I don't know if I'm doing an experiment or not, but everybody in my ward knows that I'm more an unbeliever than a believer. And I'm always bringing up things that most people would rather I didn't bring up, I guess. I don't know for sure, but so far they seem to be still loving and accepting, which is kind of surprising me. But of course, again, I'm not going public, so I'm not running into the authorities by doing it in the newspaper or something. But could you respond to that? Is that what you meant for us to speak up, or are you thinking we can speak up in another way?
Oh, first of all, thank you for that question. It's very moving and it's very humble. And I wish I had a better answer than I have. I certainly am not asking you to sacrifice your membership. I'm asking exactly the opposite, that you never, ever relinquish it on your own. But I think that if you truly love the organization you're a part of, then you must risk it. It will always be at risk. Anytime we bring ourselves to a situation, that's going to be the case. I think that the leadership of the church is going to notice if people are excommunicated in virtual droves. So you may find that you're more powerful as individuals than you think. You tip your little domino. But I'm also asking that you tip it with respect. I think that influence is earned through one thing primarily, and that thing is trust. And the trust is very specific. It's a delicate relationship between leaders and followers, and it's based on assessment of internal motives and external actions. If you have been a faithful member, if you are obviously wanting to be there and in support of the church in this world, then I think you might have influence because you have trust. But if you're saying, is there a risk-free way for me to say what I really think when I imagine leadership is gone astray, then the simple answer is no, there isn't. But with regards to leadership, when leadership is, it's imperfect. It's another human being like the rest of us, or several. And that part of them which may or may not be doing something we consider wrong is perhaps the part less developed in the qualities of leadership. Nobody's got it all. So you're really in a position as an individual, in my view, of trying to talk a toddler. That part of the leader you're talking to is the toddler. The rest may be magnificent, but the part that you're upset with is the toddler, and he's holding a loaded gun, and he's pointing it at your head, and you're saying, could you give mommy the gun? Obviously, that toddler has no intent, no reason, no wish to injure you, but most certainly can. So I am telling you, you must live at risk to be part of any organization, your church, your country, your family.
I have a question for each of you. A separate question for each of you. David, I was taking notes on something else interesting you said, and so when you got to the point about embracing our polygamous past, I missed the justification. Now, so if you could talk, are you hoping that'll, if that's hoping you'll it will create a dialogue about sex and sexuality among Mormons or between Mormons and the great, you know, our critics. Anyway, I'd like you to expand on that. And then Sean, next page. I hesitate to go here, but it would be helpful to me. Because I didn't grow up in a Mormon family or community, I don't live in Salt Lake, and at the same time, I may be guilty of the same behavior, that vile, trying to get your hurtful, anti-Mormon, prejudicial behavior. Could you identify some of the things that have been, so that maybe I can purge it personally, you know, if not for the community at large? Okay.
I would rather hear what Cheryl has to say about that question than what I'm going to say. I don't know. I think it's an open question about the polygamy thing. I just think that it doesn't, first of all, it doesn't do any good to try to hide it, the fact that we participated in that. And, you know, was it Sean Whalen who wrote that awful screed about, you know, more than one? It actually wasn't it was a screed, but it wasn't a bad idea. I liked the concept behind it, which is, hey, let's celebrate our peculiarity. You know, it wasn't a shameful thing, I don't think. Now, some of you may have different opinions, but in terms of a political discourse or social discourse about sexuality, I think it's fairly simple, and maybe I am oversimplifying it, and therefore I don't know what I'm talking about. But I will say that there are lots of different things, questions that have come up in American social discourse about sexuality. One of them is the gay issue, and just that question that gets raised up. That crystallizes the discourse in a new way. Why not talk about polygamy amongst ourselves, and who knows, maybe in a broader community, about not so much the value of polygamy and the ins and outs of it, but the fact that this was an experiment in American history, not just Mormon history, but American history, about sexuality. What were its pros? What were its cons? Why did it fail? Why did we give it up? Why can't we deal with it now? And why not look at it as, if not a model, then at least a door into the possibility that we can decenter this awful adolescent sex that pervades our media and our lives in America. It's really more in America, as far as I'm concerned, than it is, say, in Western Europe. It's just a potential on-ramp, is all I'm saying, to a conversation that could include a broader notion of sexuality.
I wasn't altogether sure what you were asking. Are you asking about personal experience with prejudicial thinking? 1.5 weeks after I moved here the first time, I was in a public laundromat, and there were garments in my laundry. I was subjected to 1.5 hours of verbal abuse. I was blocked from leaving the laundry. Oh, you're washing magic underwear. 1.5 weeks after moving here. Another, possibly good example. Let me think. They were sitting around the family table, one of my sisters-in-law's here, for the first time, surrounded by ten daughters and two sons and a Mormon family. It was extremely clear that nobody knew what to talk about. Just nobody knew what to talk about. Getting a job. When I got here, I was thinking about coming here and trying to get a job. I called someone here, and they said, well, make sure, be absolutely sure that they don't know you're non-Mormon, or you will never get work. So when the question is asked, which is designed to solicit whether you're Mormon, what ward are you in? Then your answer must be, I don't know yet, I don't have an address. That was true. Thank you.
I'm afraid we're out of time.
So we'll end this. The tapes will be available a little later today. Thank you very much for coming.